Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. In this episode, I talk with Bio member Adam Hennig about his latest book, Baseball's Outcast, The Story of Ron LaFleur, published by Bloomsbury Academic in April 2026. This interview was recorded on Zoom on April 19th, 2026. In your acknowledgments, you write about first encountering Ron LaFleur's story when you were 8 years old in 1988. Take us back to that moment. What did you see or read that got you hooked, or why did it stick to you for the next 30 years?
Well, I was a huge baseball fan growing up, but I wasn't much of a reader. But the one thing I would read were about baseball players. And I had combed through a lot of the children's section already. And there happened to be this one book that my mom had found, who was a school teacher. And she's like, I think you might like this book. And the title of it was called From Prison to the Major Leagues. Of course, that immediately caught my eye. And as I started reading it, I was like, wow, this is really interesting. I can't believe this guy who was in prison became a professional baseball player. Even at 8 years old, that seemed unbelievable. Now that I'm much older, it's actually even more astonishing, especially after spending 5 years of trying to understand how this guy, Ron LaFleur, who grew up in a really poor part of Eastside Detroit, who was caught up in drugs, who never participated in any sort of organized baseball league, was a supreme athlete, but didn't have the support system or the discipline to really exercise that when he was growing up. He dropped out of school when he was 15, was sent to prison when he was 21. And, you know, how did this guy get to become a professional baseball player? And so the story had always stood in my mind. And when I was finishing up my third book, I was thinking about what I was going to write about next. For some reason, it had just kind of popped into my mind. And I was curious, what had happened to Ron LaFleur? And so I do what anyone does in this day and age, is you Google him. And so I searched up Ron, and I noticed, first of all, he was a much better player than I had remembered. And so I was just impressed from the get-go. So not only did this guy get recruited out of prison, make it through the minor leagues, which is extremely competitive, and then not only make the major leagues, but become the star player for the Detroit Tigers. The movie that was based on his life was called One in a Million. It should have been called One in a Billion. It's just incredible what he was able to accomplish. What was interesting, too, is what happened to him after baseball, and unfortunately, didn't turn out so good.
But his story was largely told, not just in his 1978 memoir and this made-for-TV movie starring LeVar Burton, who was fresh off the movie Roots, or the series Roots. So what made you feel like there was still a biography left to write? What did you feel that was missing from the record that you needed to tell?
At the peak of Ron's fame, Ron is an all-star. He's, as I mentioned, he's the best player on the Tigers. He's actually one of the best players in the entire American League. I mean, anytime he got on base, pitchers were very much consumed with what he was going to do on the base paths, which made it much easier for the hitter because now the pitcher was distracted. And so Ron was at the peak of his playing time or his playing career. He had a beat reporter, the Tiger beat reporter. He was following Ron and asked him, hey, can I write your memoir? And so when the memoir came out, it turned into a bestseller. CBS optioned it for a made-for-TV movie, which we don't really see anymore. But at the time, every week, there was a made-for-television movie on CBS, ABC, NBC. And so on one of those weeks in 1978, it was in September, One in a Million came out. And of course, it featured LeVar Burton, who portrayed Ron LaFleur. But it only goes up to that season when he becomes an all-star. So there's a whole second half of his career that wasn't documented. The other thing, too, is the memoir left so many things out, as so many memoirs do. It didn't talk at all about his half brother growing up, who was a professional boxer and was on the same Olympic squad as Cassius Clay, who we later know as Muhammad Ali. It doesn't talk about Ron participating in the 1967 riots in Detroit, which at the time it was the deadliest riot that summer, when there were, I think, more than 40 of them in different cities. It doesn't document a lot of the anguish that he went through as a child. For example, encountering his mom sleeping with a landlord in order to pay for the month's rent. And I asked Ron about that, who's still alive, and he admitted that he was just too embarrassed to put it in his memoir. I noticed there were just a lot of things that weren't explained in the memoir, and plus it had come out almost 50 years ago, so most people wouldn't have remembered it. Ron's story, as I mentioned, it's so astonishing. I just felt like there's so many people who probably are not familiar with it. So if you don't remember Ron as a player and you're not from the Detroit area, you probably have no idea who he is. And so I felt that there was enough material to make a go out of it and write a full-length biography.
So Ron LaFleur's Detroit, redlining, police brutality, these are some of the things that you just talked about, the 67 uprising, and then of course industrial abandonment. These are very specific to the Black urban experience. But you're a Bay Area author writing about that world. So how did you know when you understood it well enough to write it versus when you were still like on the outside looking in? So how much research did you have to do to get into that headspace?
The previous books that I had written all were about the post-World War II African American experience. And so I was able to rely on context from my previous books to just kind of at least have a grasp of what I was walking into, because that was another thing the memoir didn't explain. It didn't talk anything about redlining. It didn't talk about anything about the politics at the time. And nor should it, Ron, this was just a quick, they call it a quickie. The focus was on Ron, this transformation from prison to the major leagues, and that was it. So I wanted to dive into that to explain the kind of environment that Ron was living in. And whenever I start any sort of biography, I always read. I read up on the times, people who were perhaps affiliated with this individual, to get a better understanding of what was life like back then. I read the newspaper articles. I often check out like Time Magazine, Saturday Review, Look Magazine, anything that was going on at that time to just kind of give me an idea of what it was like. And then, of course, speaking to people who knew the individual that I'm writing about, to understand, what was the neighborhood like that Ron grew up in? What was his family members like? What do you remember about his mother? And so that was very helpful. The more research you do, the better understanding you're going to have when it comes time to writing, and it's going to make the whole process much easier, and you're going to be much more successful.
For sure. You had three very different kinds of primary sources then. LaFleur's own 1978 memoir, as we discussed, your direct interviews with him, which I'm really intrigued about because you've never met him in person. You've never had any Zoom calls with him. It's just over the phone, which is fascinating. And of course, the historical record of Detroit, the Tigers, and the era. How did you weigh those against each other, especially when they didn't agree?
That is usually the hardest thing I find in writing biography. Oftentimes, you're not going to get the exact answer. And
Yeah, and
so,
you actually use footnotes to address some of these discrepancies.
yeah. And so that's basically the answer is I'll point it out. I'll say, listen, I don't know exactly if this is how it happened. This is how it was explained to me. The example that I really struggled with, and it certainly didn't impact the book at all, but it was when Ron's youngest brother was murdered. And there were different accounts. And I wanted to be respectful because the LaFleur family claimed something, and then the police report claimed something else. And so I based the narrative on the police report, but I made sure to include it as a footnote to explain, well, there's also this type of scenario as well that may have happened. So I think it's important that if it's an issue like something like that, where it's not going to have any sort of impact on the overall story or change the trajectory of the character, I think it's fine to point those things out. I think when it's something so critical that it would change or have some sort of significant impact, then you have to decide, do you want to include it? Or maybe it just stays in the back of the book, because if you're going to put something in the narrative and it has a vital impact on the trajectory of the story, you really need to be confident in the source. Luckily, I didn't have that situation, but it easily, you know, I can easily see how it could come up.
You do list the people that you interviewed for this book, and it's extensive. I'm sure you had some people that you wanted to interview initially, and that included Ron LaFleur. Who was the first person you interviewed, and how did you come up with the list of people to interview?
So the one nice thing about writing about someone who's a contemporary character is a lot of the people who knew them or know them, in Ron's case, they're still alive. So Ron was the first person I interviewed, primarily because I wanted to see if he would be available. I don't know if I would have written the book if he wasn't. Probably I would have, because there was so much information in the public record. And then, of course, doing these interviews with people who knew him in all walks of life, I'm sure there was enough information, but certainly the research, the information that he provided me, and also just fact-checking, you know, checking in, you know, is this how this happened? Or when was your mother born? Or, you know, how did your father get from Mississippi to Tennessee? Those were things that only Ron could answer, because he's the only relative left of his immediate family. But talking to Ron was interesting. It was the first time that I was writing a book about someone who was still alive. So that was a new challenge for me. And I think that there's pluses and minuses with that. The big plus, obviously, is that you're able to actually talk to the subject themselves. The downside is that you have to be careful about not getting too friendly with them. It is natural as you get to know someone. And I got to know Ron really well. So for 5 years, Ron and I spoke by telephone. It started at the height of the pandemic. Ron's not very tech savvy, so Zoom was never an option. We just spoke by phone. And sometimes those conversations were 15 minutes. Sometimes they were over an hour. Ron was very forthcoming. Initially, he was seeking some sort of payment. And when I told him that would not be available, you know, he was hesitant at first, but then he came around. And my big selling point to Ron, and it was very honest with him, is, you know, Ron, there are very few non-Hall of Famers who have a professional biography written about them in baseball or in any sport. If you think about it, most biographies, when we talk about sports figures, they're almost always in the Hall of Fame. And, you know, they're almost always on the New York Yankees or the Boston Red Sox. So for Ron LaFleur to have a dedicated biography about his life, it's not common for someone who didn't make it to the Hall of Fame and has never been discussed as someone who should. His career just wasn't long enough to justify that. And I told him, like, you know, this is your legacy. This is something that your grandchildren will remember you by, people who watched you play. You know, they may not have thought about you in the last 40 years, and this is going to hopefully resuscitate that. And so I think that helped convince him to talk with me. And I think he also saw that I was very genuine in terms of the questions. I was very respectful of his time. I always came prepared. And we just got to know each other through those conversations.
Did you record the conversations you had with him, or did you just take notes?
Both. So I would tell him in advance, you know, just remember that I am recording this, but I have no plans to ever share this with anyone. It's really just so that after the interview, I can go back and check to see if it's accurate. One of the things I did on this book, I was never able to do before because the technology just wasn't there, is I transcribed the interviews using an app. Problem was, it wasn't 100% accurate. So it just, sometimes if you you speak really fast or you garble a word, it didn't pick it up. It wasn't perfect, but it certainly helped a lot. But yeah, I would listen to the interview afterwards and then see if I missed something in my notes. And so I had my phone next to the computer. I would have it on speaker. You know, he would be talking and then I would just be typing. And I would tell him, like, listen, I'm listening to you, but I'm also typing. So I may ask you to repeat something. And again, I was always very prepared. I always had a list of questions. And sometimes, of course, our conversation would go into different directions. And so obviously it didn't always go scripted, but I was very meticulous in terms of trying to capture everything he said. And there were a few times where he didn't want it on the record. So I literally would turn off the recorder and not type, but he would share the information with me.
Ooh, juicy. To what extent did you travel to Detroit or Tampa or any of the places that he lived? Did you trace his footsteps at all? Well, he was in three different jails or prisons. Did you visit any of those?
No. So unfortunately, Tiger Stadium no longer exists. So the Detroit Tigers is one of the founding baseball franchises. And unlike Fenway Park, unlike Yankee Stadium, well, Yankee Stadium got rebuilt, but across the street, but Tiger Stadium no longer exists. It's nothing now. I think it's a ball field at best. The prison is no longer functional. So the state prison of Southern Michigan is no longer functions as a prison. So the places that I would have liked to have visited were no longer in operation. Like his childhood home, Ron never had one. He moved around, it seemed like almost every other year. So there wasn't like a neighborhood that he like grew up in. The other thing too is, again, I mentioned it was started during the pandemic. So traveling was already going to be difficult. And then as I got deeper into the book, as much as I wanted to go to Detroit, I also knew too, like, was it worth it? What was I going to see? Ron doesn't live there anymore. All of the interviews I was doing were done by phone and or by Zoom. So for this book, I didn't do the type of travel that I had done in previous books. Travel gets very expensive. So you have to really want to maximize your time. And I just didn't see the need for it on this. But I did do a lot of archival research. But again, it can all be done online now. So you just, you submit your request and then they call you for your credit card and then they'll email you whatever files you need. And that was great. And then my other big resource was eBay. So eBay is so good if you're looking for old magazines, things that you just cannot find in a library or in a bookstore. It was very helpful in finding magazines that had been out of print for decades, but had featured Ron. And I came across some great articles in there.
Wow. So you must have a whole physical archive on this man, because you've got these audio recordings, you've got these physical magazines. What are you going to do with all this stuff?
The magazines I've kept, I have some old programs and things like that. What I'm going to do with it, I don't know. Right now it is sitting on a shelf. It's in my baseball section. Most of the audio files, of course, they're not tapes or anything like that. It's all stored on my computer. So I'm finding with each book, I have less and less of a paper trail, which is kind of sad, but at the same time, that's just the times we live in.
Fascinating. I didn't think about eBay as a source of as an archival source at all. That's fascinating for a modern biography or of a modern subject.
I stole that idea from another biographer. His name was Justin, and he wrote about a Black Panther. And I was listening to his interview and he was talking about, it was Eldridge Cleaver, I think it was. And he was talking about how he got a lot of Black Panther memorabilia on eBay. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I never thought about that. And then I started looking up things, for Ron LaFleur. I was just shocked at like, oh my God, there's all this stuff. Most of it I wasn't concerned with, but some of it was obviously good enough that I purchased it.
That's so cool. Ron LaFleur had children. To what extent did they participate in these interviews and in this project?
Well, his daughter, Georgia, who's named after his mother, she provided a lot of the personal photographs that are in the book. And so she was very kind and very helpful. Ron has three children and he has a very close relationship with Georgia, but his other two children, not so much. He has a daughter from a relationship that got very contentious and resulted in him owing a significant amount of child support, which he was not paying and was eventually arrested for. So that relationship is not in existence. And then he has a son who is actually about my age. And he was a promising baseball prospect in high school. And I think he even got drafted by the Cincinnati Reds. Unfortunately, he didn't make it out of the minors. And I don't know how much contact Ron has with him. He didn't speak to him too much about him. I didn't press to speak with him. I would say about 80-90% of the book is about goes up to his last season in the majors, and then I have to, and then I realize, oh my God, I'm almost at 90,000 words, which is what I had promised the publisher, and I just don't have, how do I finish the last 30 years of his life? And so, and that's of course when he has his two kids, so there really wasn't a lot of space anyways to add anything more than I was planning to, because I do have to kind of move quickly with the last 25 years. I emulated, what's his name? He wrote a Joe DiMaggio book, Richard Ben Kramer, I think his name is. I noticed in his biography, Joe DiMaggio, he wrote extensively about him while he was a Yankee, and then he kind of skips over like 20 years of Joe DiMaggio's life and then really focuses on like his last year or two. I'm like, you know what? I think I can do that. There's a way to do that without foregoing the content, you know, and I'm hoping that I was able to do that in a way that it didn't, it seems seamless because, you know, you're essentially skipping 15, 20 years of their life.
Your previous books, Alex Haley's Roots, Baseball Under Siege, Watergate's Forgotten Hero, these show a consistent interest in figures who've been overlooked or pushed to the margins of history. Is there a through line that you use when you're thinking of a subject for your books? What constitutes an Adam Hennig biography?
Alex Haley was my first book, and he also led me, Alex Haley led me to the next two books, because Alex Haley, before he was the author of Roots, he was a journalist, and I was doing research on everything that he had ever written. And I came across this article that led me to my second book, which was Baseball Under Siege. And so it was really just an accident that I happened to write about this doctor who was responsible for integrating spring training in 1961, 14 years after Jackie Robinson had already integrated baseball. So that intrigued me. And so there was no through line there. It was just, I came across this article. No one had ever written about him other than this article that Alex Haley had written in 1960. I go through this checklist, this mental checklist. First of all, is this a topic that I'm interested in? Is this a topic that I can write about, that I'm comfortable writing about? And then I also think, has anyone else ever written about him or her? I don't like to write about someone who's already had a book written about them. I think that's really challenging, which is why I'm not interested in writing, you know, a book about Abraham Lincoln or, you know, Marlon Brando, or about Barack Obama. I mean, they've just had so many books written about them. What more can you say? Now, occasionally there is, you know, something comes out, something gets unearthed, and then all of a sudden you've got enough material. But I like to explore someone who's never just been discussed before. And I think because I started with Alex Haley, I've gravitated toward the African American experience. I just find it really interesting. Keep in mind, I wrote that book before Black Lives Matter, that expression took place. And so when that started, I think Alex Haley's Roots was just coming out at that time. There seemed to finally be this understanding, this appreciation that there's a need for more stories to be told about the Black experience. It just resonated with me. And again, I just found it really interesting. I found that there was so much more that hadn't been said. We often associate the Black experience solely through the eyes of sports or entertainment when there's so many different aspects of it that haven't really been shared. And so, and then with Ron LaFleur, I had just finished this book about Frank Wills, who was the Watergate forgotten hero. He was the security guard who detected the burglars at the Watergate office building, which eventually led to the resignation of President Nixon. And it was a book about that episode, but also about what happened to Frank Wills and how he was treated. And a lot of it was probably because he was Black that he wasn't able to monetize his success as others have, who were perhaps in a similar situation. But I wanted to do something very different. And again, Ron LaFleur, the more I looked into it, the more I realized, you know, he's checking off all the boxes. It's a story that I'm interested in, and no one else has written about him. The other thing too is there has to be a market for it. So this is where you have to put on your business cap. Are there readers? Will there be a publisher be interested in supporting your work? If you find a really obscure character that no one has ever heard of, it is going to be a much harder sell, and their story is going to have to be that much more intriguing. So I took someone who is known to people who are like hardcore baseball fans over the age of 60 or are from Detroit. And that's a pretty small audience, so I knew it was going to be a tough struggle to try to get an agent and go with one of the big five. Luckily, Bloomsbury was gracious enough to accept the story, and it also helped too that I had already written about 80% of it. So I was able to give them a definitive timeline of when it would be done. I had shown them all of the research that I had conducted, and I was already working on getting the permissions back for interviews and for images. So I made it very easy for them, and I figured that helped a lot in trying to get on their roster. You know, I think every biographer has their own way of selecting characters. It's very personal because you spend a lot of time with them. I mean, I spent 6 years essentially working on the Ron LaFleur book. That's a lot of time, you know, to spend on just one thing. But I, you know, it's a labor of love, and I enjoy it, and I'm already thinking about my next book.
Of course you are. Care to share?
Well, here's what I will say. It has nothing to do with sports, and it's the first time I'm going to be writing about multiple characters. It's not just going to be an exclusive single person biography. I'm excited about that because I think it's important to challenge yourself and not always stay in your comfort zone. And that's fine if you do, but for me personally, I like to always jump around with different topics. It keeps me interested. It keeps me on my seat. I like a little bit of an edge, doing something again that no one's written about before. So I'm excited.
Ooh, I'm excited too. I'll be following. So Ron LaFleur is 77 now. What has he said about this biography since it's been out? And what do you hope this book does for his legacy?
So I sent co a copy to Ron. He called me maybe within a week. And I knew what it was going to be about. And I was already kind of prepared to respond. Now, first of all, I just want to say I told Ron that there's nothing in this book that is going to surprise you. No one revealed something that I know that you're not already aware of. You know, Ron had a mixed reputation in the clubhouse, for example. I interviewed a former bat boy who liked Ron as a player, but not as a person. And he made that very clear in the interview. And he was willing to go on record about that. You know, so there were plenty of characters who did not appreciate Ron. There were people in the front office, coaches, they just couldn't stand Ron. And that's all in the book. But then there were people who praised Ron. So I tried to be balanced. But Ron did take issue with certain things. I can tell he hadn't read the whole book. He kind of probably more or less skimmed it because he told me, he's like, you know, listen, I haven't read this thing page to page, but you know, there were a couple things I saw and you know, and he didn't go into the details of what they were. And I didn't press him. I didn't want to. The legacy of Ron LaFleur is, you know, the legacy of just someone who had not had any sort of opportunity, who wouldn't have had any sort of opportunity in life to probably make it past his 25th birthday, and instead has this amazing baseball career, able to somehow find a way within himself to see the light and commit himself while he's incarcerated, while he's in solitary confinement, while he's questioning his own existence. And luck certainly played a role in his life, and I point that out on several occasions. The timing of Ron, of him growing up, was so crucial to his success in becoming a professional baseball player. It shows the impact of when you have services available for individuals, particularly behind bars. Ron happened to be the beneficiary of having a warden at that time of the prison that he was in, who was very much a supporter of providing positive recreational programs for the inmates in hopes that, first of all, they'll experience better behavior while they're incarcerated and they'll have more success in the outside. Unfortunately, by the time Ron left, all of those programs would disappear. And a lot of it had to do with just simply funding. But in Ron's case, he was able to benefit from that. They had all these recreational leagues. They created a furlough program where he was able to leave for 48 hours, which is how he was able to get to his tryout. He was able to secure his GED. They had an honors dormitory, so he was not with the general population. He had a lot more freedom. And all of those things were incentives for him to behave in a positive way and to not re-enter the criminal justice system. And that was one of the things that I learned about, and I was very I enjoyed writing about, because I saw how, if we can do this in today's times, I think we would not have to spend so much money on those who are incarcerated. I live in California, and it's one of the biggest budgets at the state level is the Department of Corrections. And what we spend on an inmate is so much more than what we spend on a child going to school. And there's something wrong with that.
Yeah, that's one of the things I really loved about this biography was that, sure, baseball was the overarching theme of the book, but underneath it all was this very personal story and a struggle with all things poverty and Detroit and imprisonment. And you wrote for a broader audience than just a baseball fan.
And that was intentional. This was not going to be just another baseball biography. I'm not into reading those, and I don't think most people are. Whenever you write about, let's say you're writing about a movie star or you're writing about a politician, there has to be more than just what you see in front of you. And that's what always makes such a great biography, providing the context and just providing those stories that people are not so much familiar with.
Well, I think you succeeded. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us, and I'm excited to see what you work on next.
Thank you, Jenny. This has been great.
That was my conversation with bio member Adam Hennig about his latest book, Baseball's Outcast: The Story of Ron LaFleur. It was published by Bloomsbury Academic in April 2026. This interview was recorded on Zoom on April 19th, 2026. To learn more about bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Ellian Marie Fillengaines created our podcast theme music. Carolyn Van Putten is our assistant producer. Sheree Newman is our engineer, and Sonia Williams is our executive producer. I'm producer Jenny Skoog in New York City. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.